You're going to absolutely love today's podcast. I have the head of performance from World Tour team Bora Hansgrove joining me today, Dan Larang. This podcast is interesting. Most of us are curious about how the top riders in the world train. What are they eating? What sessions are they doing? But that's not what today's podcast is. Today, I try and deconstruct everything Dan knows about performance with a view to applying it to busy cyclists, people who have conflicting demands in their time, someone who's balancing work with family, with social commitments. Some absolutely incredible insights that I really wish I knew at the start of my cycling journey. You're going to love this episode with Dan Larang. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Dan, you've worked with some of the very best athletes in the world. Today, what I want to do is not focus the conversation on how to coach elite athletes. I want to focus the conversation on lessons from those elite athletes that everyday amateurs can apply into their own training and into their own life. Does that sound like a reasonable proposition?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also a reason for why we have high performance sport, to learn from there and to give it to, let me say, normal people. So that's why, let's have a chat about it.
Yeah, that trickle down is interesting. And we see it in many industries like Formula One. The tip of the spear innovates. And then years later, we get that mainstream adoption. So you get changing your gears with paddles in Formula One cars in the 90s. And now your family saloon, you can change your gears with paddles. So I'm hoping cycling follows the same kind of template.
Yeah, I think it's often like this. So you are striving for high performance, and in different departments in high performance sport, training, nutrition, material, aerodynamics, and so on. And on that search, you find probably something what you can break down then years later to, like I said, to age group athletes, to normal athletes, or even to normal persons. And that is also quite interesting how you can use that knowledge then to make benefit people, for example, if they are doing sports for their health only, and still they can learn something from high performance training. So always good to take something from there. And it's like, for example, why do we fly to the on the moon? So that's also a thing. So you try to achieve something really big, and on the way you discover something what you can then use also for a larger amount of people.
Before we jump into tackling that topic, I have to tickle my own curiosity. What's it like working with Primoz Roglic?
Yeah, so we are really happy to have him in the team. He's a really accessible guy. So it's not that he's the big star there and that you need a special audience to talk to him. So it's really, from the first moment on, he really welcomed the team, and he was really welcomed in the team, what is nice. And we also brought from Visma his coach Mark to our team, what also makes things easier for both parties, for Primoz for sure, because he can continue on the daily basis with his coach, and also from others, from our side, to better or faster understand the athlete and the human being, Primoz Roglic, and to help him to have the perfect environment to perform.
Do leaders like that raise the standard? Obviously, you guys have had some Grand Tour success with Jay Hindley in Giro a couple of seasons back, but does someone like Roglic come in and redefine standards, or is that something you're independently just pressing ahead and trying to be a better version of yourselves year on year?
I think it supports this. So for sure, in high performance sport, you always try to wake up in the morning and try, or when you go to bed, to say, okay, what did I do today better than yesterday? And so on. So which are the progresses that I made? But having a guy who can really win these big races, or another guy who can win these big races, that motivates the whole team, that motivates every single person, no matter if it's the coach, the mechanic, the physio, the head of performance, or whatever it is, the general manager. And also, and it's also really important for the other athletes. So basically, they see a world-class athlete who is living every day for his goals, for his dreams. And then he can also be a role model without changing himself. So he has just to be himself. And this is already enough to raise the bar and also show to other athletes what you really have to do if you want to be successful. And what Primoz is also doing well is he never loses the fun. So you always see that he has a lot of fun in what he's doing. So it's not a job, but it's really something what he likes to do. And I think this is also a big asset what you need to be a world-class athlete. When I compare to other world-class athletes that I was happy to work with, this is for sure a common point, comparing women, men, no matter what it is. But those athletes who really achieve the top, they really love what they are doing.
Let's dive in and talk about broad strokes. I want to start broad and then get more detailed and granular as the conversation progresses. Do you think there's an overall coaching philosophy that amateur athletes should be subscribing to?
So I think an overall philosophy could be that if we talk about endurance sport, consistency is quite important. So it's not about the one key session, about one big day that you have to do. It's more about giving your body constantly a certain amount of load. And to realize this, load management is quite important. So to avoid injuries, to avoid sickness, to avoid, probably also mental issues. So, and that is something what is the same for high performance athletes, but also for recreational athletes. So that you take care about this balance between load and recovery. And I could now list a lot of systems in your body, bones, tendons, muscles, cardiovascular system, and so on and so on, what all plays a role there. So that's why I think one general thing is to develop a training system where you are able to do your sport over a long period consistently. And if you are able to do this, in general, also performance is coming. So for sure, it's not only that. If you're just only running easy and if every training session is 1 hour easy running, for sure at some point you will make no progress anymore. But this is a good foundation, a good base. And always when you see that you are often sick, you have often pain somewhere, you feel often fatigued, then there's something wrong with what you are doing. So it's probably not a coaching philosophy. It's more like, okay, what does it really need to be successful or to be good in endurance sport? And this is consistency.
Well, I think that's a great place to anchor this conversation, because maybe that's also one of the areas where high performance athletes and amateurs should differ. That the lens that we view high performance through is a shorter term lens. Even if we look at a long career, it spans 15 years. Whereas we look at the career of an amateur athlete, this can span multiple decades. So the actions we take in the short term for high performance athletes aren't necessarily the same actions you would take if you're looking to optimize over a 30, 40, 50 year period.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you have a professional athlete, so he or she's basically, so the income is also linked to basically the level of success that the athletes have. So it sounds not so romantic, but it's also a job. So they also have to earn money for themselves, for their family and so on, probably also already for the future. And for this, for sure, if you want to be successful, you come really close to the border, what is possible and what is probably a little bit too much. So I think, and that is really something where you have to look into. And I think when you take an amateur athlete, it's not necessary to go so close to that border. I think that's really important to understand. Exactly like what you said, Anthony, it's they want to do this sport over the decades. They want to keep the body healthy. And high performance sports, I would not say that this is healthy. We have to make really clear on that. It's not that we want to hurt the health of the athletes or that we try to damage that, but for sure it's not healthy to do 30, 35 hours of sport every week over a whole year and so on and so on. So probably also when we look at studies, where is the benefit of sports? So where do you have the most benefit concerning your health? Normally we talk, I think it's about 6-7 hours, something there. And after that, already the positive effects get a little bit less. And so if we talk about 30 hours, it has nothing to do with health. It's necessary for high performance to bring your body to that limit. But there should be a difference. And I think there, it's always good if the high performance athlete just has a small reserve between that border where you have too much. The amateur athlete should leave quite a bigger reserve for that.
I wonder, is there like a law of diminishing returns at play here? Because I know last year in the summer, I'd done some big rides and, you know, some 200 kilometer plus rides. And it always struck me when friends asked, how was the ride? I always had the same answer. I said, the fun went out of it about 160 kilometers in, and it felt like a chore after that. So maybe this is a simplistic view, but do you think actually enjoying the whole process should underpin any long-term training plan?
So I think also something what is similar between world-class athletes and amateur athletes could really be the process. So if you love the process to get to a certain goal, it's a day-by-day thing. It's not just, okay, you have a special cycling marathon or a triathlon that you want to do, and that's the only goal, and you do everything for this. No, I think it's important to go on a daily basis and to enjoy that process, and also to be aware of there is not this master plan. So it's not that you can say this is the one and only training plan that leads you to this goal, because individual adaptations have to be made. There are different ways to get there. So basically you should be aware on a daily basis what is good, what is not good, where do I have to make an adaptation. So that's why I would think if you love, for example, that process that you get better week by week, month by month, you love to have good nutrition, to take care about training, about good recovery, and so on and so on. That's much more fulfilling than just having that goal and basically every day after work, after 8-9 hours of work, forcing you to do the training just to achieve that one goal. I think that's just not big enough to do that. It's more to look behind that and see what can sport give me more than just achieving a goal that I set myself.
So if we start to zoom in a little bit now, we talked about the philosophy. Now, if we zoom in a little bit and we look at a macro training plan. So if we assume, which I think is a fair assumption, that an athlete, especially a time-crunched one, only has three levers they can pull in terms of their training sessions. They have the frequency of their training sessions, they have the duration of their training session, so how long is a session, and then they have the intensity within that session. How should they think about manipulating these three variables, frequency, duration, and intensity?
Mm-hmm. So I think a general approach is always, and that is something what you find in all the training exercise books, if you bring up intensity, you have to decrease the volume. So if we talk about one specific session, if you do, for example, a VO2 max session, no matter in which sport, for sure this is the session who should not be probably a 3 or 4 hour session. But this is the short session. If you're doing something with an easy endurance, fat metabolism training, easy endurance training, so aerobic endurance training, for sure this session can be much longer. So basically these are already two parameters where you are working vice versa. So if you increase volume, you decrease intensity, and the same in the other way around. And it is for one single session, but it's also for your weekly or your monthly training. Let's say if you're training, for example, like 3 weeks loading and 1 week's recovery, then basically in this 3 weeks loading, when you go up with the volume step by step, normally in the last week, you probably decrease intensity to be able to have a higher volume. And then, like you said, if it comes to density, so how often should you train? I think this is then the last parameter to adapt. So basically, first you increase volume, after you add intensity, and the last one is that you then open up some more training days, or you put more sessions with a shorter rest period. And that's exactly why you are doing this, because if you go a higher in density, the recovery time is shorter, and that's what you have to take care of. And I always say, and that's the same for the professional, in the first training phase, you always have to build up some resilience. So resilience, I mean that your body is able to support the training load that you want to give to the body.
Yeah.
And that is for all the systems, bones, tendons, no matter what it is. And this needs a certain amount of time before you start then with the real training process. And that is similar from the world-class athletes to the amateur athlete.
Unfortunately, there's a situation in the cycling coaching economy where everyone is a cycling coach. The guy who decorates your house, the painter and decorator, he'll also do a bit of cycling coaching for you on the side. There seems to be thousands of cycling coaches, but that doesn't mean there's thousands of good cycling coaches. What I worry with cycling coaching at the moment is that they've taken the philosophy from training the top level guys, and they are applying this to time-crunched riders. And by that I mean, if we look at data on what we know is good for somebody long-term, like the amount of time under tension they need with strength and conditioning each week, the importance of mobility exercise, the importance of stretching, core work, physiotherapy, all these supportive stuff. But you take a rider who only has 10 hours a week for a total training time because of family and work commitments, and they go into one of these amateur coaches. This amateur coach now allocates their full 10 hours a week to on the bike and quite a lot of intensity into that. I feel like they're missing so many of the benefits from strength and conditioning, mobility, all that other stuff listed. Hey, Roadman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day. But I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Adam right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Adam's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike.
I think it's really important to, and that's why it's good to have a coach, also another level, to put priorities. So exactly what you said, depending on the time that you have, you should fix what can you put into the training and what, so with which training do you have the biggest effects? So if you train for a cycling marathon, for example, for sure, the most important thing is to be on your bike. So if you just have 8 hours of training, or if you have 8 hours of training, probably you cannot put 4 hours from these 8 hours into strength training, because this is not the limiting factor at some point. So you have always to see how much time do you have, and then make prioritization of depending on your goal. If you do a sprint triathlon, if you're doing, a cycling marathon, a cycling race, or whatever it is. And there you can also learn from the pro. You can make some kind of periodization. For example, an amateur athlete in the winter, basically, probably the weather is not so good. You train a lot indoor. Probably there you can put more focus on strength and more focus on core and so on. And then coming into the season, you can reduce that and then really train in the sport that you want to be good. So to find the right balance here. Because with amateur athletes, normally you don't start the season in January like the professionals are doing, but you start your season probably March, April, May, somewhere there. So you have enough time that you can spend on building your endurance. So it's always finding the right balance. So how much time do you have? And then looking also about how is your weekly plan? So probably from Monday to Friday, you just have every second day 1 hour. Probably there you can put some intensity if you have just 1 hour. And then on the weekend, when you have more time, you can probably put your longer session. So that's why the training plan has to be adapted to your specific situation.
Is there something that you wouldn't skimp on? Do you think we should be doing mobility and strength and conditioning all season around?
So I think what is important is the mobility and core stability. And so basically that your body has resilience. So basically that, for example, if you are 3 hours on the bike and you get always back pain, for sure you have to do something. So you should prepare your body that it's ready to support the load that you want to put. We talk about cycling, so that we want to put in cycling. I think if you're doing now squats or bench press or leg press or whatever, this is not going to make you necessarily faster on the bike. This can give you some basic strength, but the transfer from the strength exercise to the bike is probably 50-50. Probably you're working more with, plyometrics, something what is a little bit more functional. And this is something what you then should keep over the whole season. But it's not a one-hour session three times a week. It's probably just a 20-minute session three times a week. So keeping it short, but continuously doing it. It makes no sense to make core training at the beginning of the season three times a week, 1 hour, and then skipping it somewhere when you start to race, because then you will lose it. Because everything what you don't train, you will lose again. So better to, from the beginning on, to build something consistency, something what you can do consistently, and then reduce it to the minimum, what is really necessary for that sport. In cycling, it's different than in triathlon, it's different than in running, it's different than in, field and track or whatever.
I think a lot of time-crunched athletes fall into the same trap and they create one sacrificial lamb because it takes up the most time. And that's typically endurance riding, zone two riding, because by its very nature, it needs to be done for extended periods of time. You mentioned athletes kind of optimizing around their environment. Is there a case to be made for in the winter we can substitute some of our endurance riding for cross-country skiing, or when we get into the summer season, can we substitute it for walking if we're time crunched? Does it have the same physiological adaptations?
100%. So I think that is a big benefit what amateur athletes have, that they can really build their base with different sports. Basically, it's about moving. Let's take heart rate. Basically, we want to have physical adaptation and we want to have a certain amount of time in a certain amount of training zone. And there, sometimes it doesn't matter if you do it a VO2max interval now by running, by cross-country skiing or on the bike, because we want an unspecific adaptation at that moment. We want to increase your general VO2max. For sure, if you're doing it on the bike, the expert will say it's a little bit different because you are using the muscles that you are really using during the biking. But in the winter, this is not so important. It's more important that you can do it and that you can also choose between different training methods or different training disciplines. And it's also good for the head, so it makes fun. And also it develops your skills in a larger way, what is quite good also for amateur athletes and more sustainable in the winter with bad weather, with long working times and so on. So I am a big fan of that.
How do you think about measuring the adaptation for it? If I go for a 3-hour bike ride, we would normally think, around 30 training stress points per hour for a zone 2 ride. If I went for a 3-hour walk, should I attribute the same training stress score to it? Is there a linear relationship?
I think training stress score is probably hard to take that one. I would more go on a heart rate. So basically to say, okay, how much time, let me say your aerobic endurance heart rate is between 120 and 140. And then to say how much time did I spend now in that zone by doing the sport that I did. Probably on the bike, it will be 120 to 130. Probably when you run, it's 130 to 140, but that you spend enough time in that training zone. One trap where you can fall in is with running, because running is quite demanding for your bones, for your tendons. So if somebody says, I have a 2-hour ride on my program and he's now replacing it by a 2-hour run, it's something completely different for the muscles, for the bones. And there sometimes also the injury are happening because the athlete says, hey, cool, I go outside. It's cold, but running is always good. I don't get cold. And then he starts running. And after 1.5 hour, everything is just hurting. Probably knee pain starts. So running is a discipline, or every sport where you have an impact are disciplines that you have to build up step by step. Not because you cannot do it from the cardiovascular system, but just because your bones, tendons, and so on are not ready for it. So you have to build it up step by step. It's not the case with cross trainer, with cross country skiing, with there's some sports where you don't have this impact.
I love the idea of the Pareto principle, where 20% of our inputs create 80% of our outputs. And I'm wondering if we could apply that to the high-performance setup. Obviously, a team like Bora, they're blessed to have a big budget. And with that comes performance chefs, sports psychologists, physiotherapists. Is there anything from that high-performance ecosystem that you think amateurs are missing, or they're neglecting, or they're missing a big trick by not working with one of these professionals?
So the first thing is having a coach. I think that's quite important. Why? Because at least a coach can try to figure out the best load management. So basically looking at your situation and then helping you to find the right balance, what we talked before, between load and recovery. Like I said, if you have a 10-hour working day, also this should have an influence on what you are doing in training. And having a person who can help you on that side, I think that's quite valuable. If you have a good coach, he can probably also help you already in, or a good coach, somebody who is a little bit wider, he can also help you probably in nutrition, because this would be the second topic to say, okay, nutrition-wise, what can I do nutrition-wise? Like, which effect does nutrition have on training adaptation, on training itself? I think here you can even do it if we have, for example, some consultation sessions. So probably having a nutritionist that you say, okay, I visit him once, probably 3 weeks later again, and 3 weeks later again. So having 3 or 4 sessions, and then normally you have already a lot of knowledge on amateur athlete that you can work on your own with it. I think it's also good advice. And one last thing is also how you are sitting on your bike when we talk about recycling. So do you have an efficient position on your bike? Biomechanically, aerodynamics probably, depending if you are doing time trials or triathlons, but especially biomechanically, so that you are not, you don't come into a situation that you get some kind of injury, some kind of overloading of your tendons because you have a bad bike position. I think that would also be a shame to lose weeks or months of training just because probably your saddle height was 1 centimeter too low. So these are the points where I think it's important to invest. It doesn't take so much time, but they have a big impact. And after this comes all the other stuff, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's great advice as well. And they're modest enough financial commitments, especially compared to the price of bikes and stuff we see at the moment. You'd be better off buying a mid-level bike and investing into some of these consultations. You'd probably have a much better outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I also would say with the amount of money you put in these days in a bike. Basically, this consultation is basically for free already. But and it's had so much value. So it gives you something, an education, what you can use on the daily basis. You know, if you have an expensive bike, probably some years later you change your bike. But these basics things, what you get on training, on nutrition, and so on, they will last, I would say, nearly forever, because these basic recommendations, they are not changing so much. Probably some details are changing about different supplements, or if you now take 80 gram of carbs, 100 gram or 90, but the basic recommendations, if you once have this, you have them for your whole career. And I think that's a good investment.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, Rom, which underpins a lot of what you're saying, it's consistency. Not missing sessions. And when I think about the barriers for an amateur athlete with consistency, it's normally time management. It's how do we manage our family responsibilities, our work responsibilities, and still fit training in. I know you've worked with two of the greatest triathletes ever, Jan Frodeno and Lucy Charles Barkley. They get through so much work in a week. They do so many training sessions in a week. Is there any lessons around time management you learned from being in close proximity to them that you think amateur athletes could apply to their lives? Rob Mann, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part? It's the flavors. There's 8 crazy, beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
I think to make a good plan. So basically what they are doing when, no matter which training platform we are using, let's say TrainingPeak, for example, so they put their private appointments into their platform. And then already you as a coach see, okay, there probably there's an appointment that can take some time. There's a photo shooting and so on. And then immediately in your planning, you put all the way, so you try already there to have a good load management. So that you incorporate this additional load by, let's say, photo shooting in the whole concept. And if I take an amateur athlete, basically what I would do is sitting there, looking at my working week or looking at my work, family, and so on, putting it in my calendar and being also honest to myself. So not saying, okay, this will take 45 minutes. But you know, sometimes you also need to, for example, if you do a session, you have to take a shower, or you have to dress you and so on and so on. But really putting these blocks and then seeing really what is the free time what I have. And then when you start to build your training to really incorporate all this into the plan already. What people try in general is they get a training plan and try to fit it in somehow. And then it just ends up in pure stress, and sickness is just a consequence out of it. But, and like this, the professionals are not doing it. The professionals, they have their appointment. For sure, it's their job. So that's why they have more time for recovery, more time for the training. But they give their appointments to their coach, and then we try to align it. Or even in advance, we are looking when I have to do a photo shooting, when do we probably have a recovery week where we have less training, and then we plan it like that. So planning is basically the biggest milestone there. So a good planning in advance.
It's a subtle shift, but I remember having Matej Mohoric on the podcast. And again, he made another subtle shift in the way I thought about training. And he said it took him nearly a decade to realize that the function of training was to get faster in races. And that sounds like a very simplistic statement on its surface, but a lot of us view the function of training as to complete training sessions or to put green boxes across our entire week on training peaks. But the goal is to get an adaptation from that. And I think that can be lost. And like what you're saying there about planning really underscores the importance of that. We're trying to get an adaptation, not just do stuff for the sake of doing it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's why I also don't like to comment every session like, oh, that was a great session, or that was perfect, or whatever. It's not about that one session. It's about the whole block, what you have to do to be successful then in the races. And I always say the race is basically our best performance diagnostic. So we train for racing. And in training, there could be some good days, some bad days, but I'm not the fan to say we need to create some new best results in training. I even try to avoid this. So we want to have the best new results in the competition, physically and also mentally. Because if you always come mentally to a point, you have to do a critical power testing again and again and again in training. At some point, you just get fatigue in your head. So you have to make these best values in the race. For sure, you have to prepare it. But in training, you can also be fatigued and still the session can be good. I had a case yesterday and Nesli called me before the session. She said, I'm feeling quite tired. Should I do the session like this? What do you think? And I said exactly what you said. Yes, we want to do it as long as the quality stays in a range, what is still acceptable. But we want to give that load. Even if you run 5 seconds slower on a K, that doesn't matter. But we need that load, basically, to come to our final result. And that's why, on the other hand, also competitions are always competitions. So when I send athletes to a competition, we always go there to have the best possible results, not for testing or for having already an excuse before we start. So competition is competition, and we use that as a competition.
How do you weigh up like subjective feedback from an athlete like that? And like, what weight would you give to that against, say, heart rate variability or resting heart rate of an athlete?
Mm-hmm. I like to, so if I can choose, I like to have both. So some measurements, if we take that case, for example, from that athlete, there we have heart rate variability, we have resting heart rate, we have the sleep, so over every day. And then you look at the trends. And then you, for me, this is somehow 50%. And then the 50%, what is the athlete saying? And then it also depends on which athlete is saying what. So it could be that two athletes saying I'm tired, but it means something different. So the scale of saying I'm tired is different from athlete to athlete. This is something where you have to make some kind of calibration as a coach working together with an athlete over the first weeks and months. And then I look at the data. Then I look at, I listen quite carefully to what the athlete is saying. And then I give a frame and say, okay, look, this is the frame that we are working in. So if you are doing this interval and you can stay in that frame, you continue. But if you drop in the first two intervals already the quality at that point, then we skip and then you just make an easy run or an easy ride and we reset the program. So then the athlete is clear and knows, okay, that's what he wants from me. He understood that I'm tired, but it's okay. And that also gives some reassurance for the athlete. So the athlete is then sure, okay, it's fine that I'm tired. And it's fine if I have not my personal best session today. And for some athletes, this is important to have this confidence also that the coach say, hey, it's fine to be like this. Some other athletes, they don't care. They are already so long in the business, they know what to do. But from some other athletes, they need that info from the coach.
Everyone has a power meter now. You know, when I started out cycling, I forged a loan application in the bank and bought a 2,500 euro power meter. I told the bank I needed a car to go to college. And I think I was like the only one in Ireland who had a power meter. Now I go out on a group ride and every Cat 4 and Sportif guy has a power meter. And I often wonder, are we too focused on output rather than input, with heart rate being our input and the power being our output? Should more of us be listening to and observing heart rate as a metric for judging intensity?
I'm honest, I'm a big fan of heart rate. So if I would have to choose between one of both, I would always take heart rate. Because heart rate is, and I see it exactly like I said, heart rate is always the reaction of your body to something, to a load that you give. So basically you put in some words and you get a reaction over the heart rate. And the heart rate really tells you what is going on there. For sure, it's nice to have both because then you can really compare. But I'm always happy to have a heart rate and would take decisions sometimes more based on heart rate than now on watts. With watts, you always have I give a simple example, what everybody understands. If you are in Sierra Nevada and you ride up from 700 meters up to 2000 meters and you have a basic endurance of 200 to 230 watts, and you try to keep this, for sure it will not work because at 1600 meters, the intensity zones are shifting. But if you say the athlete, you stay at 130 heart rate, that is still the same. So 130 heart rate, athlete has to drop the power depending on the altitude, and it's just more accurate. The only thing where power is just more powerful is short intensity stuff. If you're doing 30-30s or something like this, the heart rate is just too slow to use it as a control mechanism or to use it as intensity control. There, for sure, power or even speed is more accurate for hitting the right intensity.
And you know, the example you gave of riding up the side of Sierra Nevada, the only difference there is an additional stressor has been introduced, altitude. But for amateur athletes, we're getting introduced by additional stressors every day of the week. Like I remember jumping on the Watt bike last week and I had two 20-minute efforts to do at 350 watts. And the previous week, I'd done the two 20-minute efforts at 350 watts at around 150 heartbeats, 150 to 153 heart rate. And for whatever was happening this following week, I jump on and at 350 watts, I'm at 175 beats, like straight away. And I'm getting heart rate drift. Towards the end of the interval, I'm up over 180 beats. Firstly, it's like a totally different adaptation, I'm guessing, at a different heart rate. But secondly, it's mentally draining to be able to perform that session when we're using power as a guidance.
Yeah, exactly. And also at that moment where you see that heart rate, let me say it like this, when you start on your bike and you do the warm-up and you see your heart rate is already, I don't know, 5 to 10 beats higher than it should be in general, then you also know, okay, something is different here. So probably my body is still working on something what I did in the, yesterday. Probably an infection is coming, but something is different. Probably I should adapt what I plan to do. So probably at that day, if you have on your program intervals, probably you should just skip them, doing an easy session and look what happens with your body. Because there is a reason why your heart rate is 5 or 10 beats up. And the reason, sometimes people say, yeah, but I know I drank a glass of alcohol or something like this. Yes, but still, the heart rate is higher. The same with heat. So it's 30 degrees. I know my heart rate will be 10 beats higher. Yes, but then you have to adapt it because exactly what you say. Otherwise, you're just targeting a different intensity. So you're targeting a different effort from your body. So there is a reason why heart rate is higher. So it has to be considered in the load management.
We've kind of, when I'm chatting to, I chat to a lot of World Tour riders on the podcast, and I've noticed a shift in the last couple of years. People used to talk a lot about training stress score. They used to talk a lot about normalized power. The vocabulary has shifted where a lot of people are now talking about kilojoules. Can you explain to me why we started talking about kilojoules? And is this a terminology that amateurs should adopt?
MyWoosh is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yep, it's absolutely free. And setting up MyWoosh is really easy. Just download the MyWoosh app, connect your device like your watt bike or your smart trainer, and off you go. Now, if you're feeling competitive, there's weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. Now, if you've no plan to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to really push you to your limits. You can enjoy daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the MyWoosh app and have a look around. Why spend money on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when MyWoosh offers all of this for free? So join MyWoosh today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or click on the link in the show notes to get started.
I think the reason for this is, let me say, we have two athletes. They go to the lab, they're making a performance test. Both are fresh. Both come out with a threshold of 420 watts, or I don't know, at 6 watt per kilo. And then in a race, you see a completely different outcome. So, people always think, yeah, but why? Basically, we are at the same level. We have the same threshold, even probably the same metabolic profile, like VO2 max and lactate bilirubin. Everything seems to be the same. Why is that guy better than me? And then in the last years, there were some studies who took a look at that, and they found out that differences come up after a certain amount of work has been done. Or let me say, call it like this, after a certain amount of energy has been spent. So after 2 or 3 hours, after 2,000, 3,000 kilojoules have been spent, there seems then there are differences from the same. So from these two athletes, you see that every athlete is reacting differently in a state of fatigue. And that's why now comes up more and more this terminology, kilojoules, also nutrition. Became a much higher importance in the last years because everybody saw, if I fuel myself with 80, 90, 100 grams of carbs per hour, my performance level at the end of the race is much higher as it has been before. And it's just by adding more sugar in a special way to the body just to keep the performance level high. In the past, it was completely different. In the past, it was always to try to eat less and try to avoid too much carbs and so on and so on. So this completely changed, and there's a much higher focus on energy intake, on energy consumption, and also on what kind of effort is possible at the end of a race. Because when you look at the cycling race, the races are normally not decided in the first 2 hours, but probably in the last hour. And there comes up big differences between world-class rider and probably riders who brings the same physiology from the lab, but still there seems to be a difference. And now science is looking more deeper and deeper into the details. What are the differences? How can we manipulate them? Or how can we even detect them to make a higher differentiation between the different riders?
Super interesting. Dan, I think this has been super helpful for amateur athletes. Just before I finish up, is there anything that you feel I've missed? Is there anything else that the pros are doing that you think would have, you know, effective implementation to an amateur athlete's life and training?
We just talked briefly about this recovery. So I think that's really a big point where the professionals take care about that they recover enough. So let me say they train four to six hours a day, and then they have still a lot of time to take care about their recovery. And when you are an amateur athlete, and like I several times mentioned already, when you are working 8 to 10 hours and when you have a high stress level, you have to take this into account. Probably it's better just to make an easy training to come down and to shift intensity to a day where you are, where don't have so much stress. So you always have to find the right balance here to keep consistency. That is what professionals are try to do, not getting sick, avoiding injuries and so on. So we talked already about this, but really also having the courage to say, okay, today I leave the bike. Or like what I said, after the first 20 minutes, the heart rate is just so much higher than it should be, just to say, okay, today I call it a day, probably not the best day to go to train. So I'll see what comes tomorrow. That is also what professionals are doing. So it's not just training hard, but it's training smart, what will make the difference. And I think it's the same for amateur athletes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I chatted to Olaf Boo on the podcast, and he talked about Eden and Blumenfeld. A lot of time they'll forgo massages, ice baths, wearing compression boots in favor of just getting more sleep, because he said sleep is undeniably the lever they pull where they reap the greatest return on their recovery.
Yeah, exactly. So I completely agree on Olaf. The sleep. So if you can manipulate the quality of sleep, that can have a high impact on your recovery and also on your performance. And this starts already with, when do you turn off your phone before going to bed? What are the last news that you are reading before you go to bed? So when you feel that your sleep is bad, so that you wake up in the morning and that you're still completely dead, try to change that. Probably it's better than to change something in training. Just take a look at it. Why is my sleep not so good? Probably the last training session was so close to going to bed that it just was not possible. So there are a lot of factors how you can manipulate sleep. And sleep is still the most efficient methods to recover. So that's really important. Then the nutrition. Take care that you have your nutrition on a regular basis. So like I said here, it's always good if you have a consultation with a nutritionist 2 or 3 times, and it really helps you just to arrange your day to adapt it to your situation. And then you can already achieve a lot just by recovering better from the session. So you're doing still the same training sessions, but just better recovery helps you also to perform better, to get a better outcome.
Dan, this is brilliant. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I know you have a lot of things on your plate, but I know amateur athletes listening to this will have benefited an awful lot.
Yeah, thank you very much, Anthony. It was a really nice chat. And one last thing, probably what I want to add, because we talk about recovery. When we have an eight-hour day or 8 hour trainings per week, for sure, this is not something where you need to go every day to the physiotherapist, where you have to do all this recovery stuff like ice bathing, like what you said now, what the Norwegians are doing. And there's a reason for this, because if, for example, the athlete is doing after every session an ice bath, so if you always bring down the inflammation that you create, then also the adaptation is less. And if you have just 8 hours of training, you should be take care of that you not basically shut down all these adaptations too early. The same with if you have too much antioxidants and all that stuff. So there, be careful that you not overdo it. But with sleep, you can do nothing wrong. So sleep, recovery, you can do nothing wrong. And that's the most important part of recovery.
Dan, thank you very much.
So if you like this video, you should definitely check out this video, because I know you're going to love it. And don't forget to subscribe to the channel.